But as for me, give me liberty! Oh, give me death!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given rights, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at revolution.radio.
This is the People's War. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so orient. Makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio of FreedomSlips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Rest, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
We can change.
I really do credit that as to why I'm able to, you know, get these types of clips, because Alex's whole mentality was, you know, go where the story is.
Use them. They don't really do the things that those other generations did, like read books and, learn how to use a blueprint to make something. But those ideas are just gone. And if you remember, I think Generation X really was the last generation of kids that had magazines that you could like mail order little kits to do things, and you could build rockets or you could build engines. You could be a little scientist as a kid, and all you needed is a subscription to a magazine where that kid would read and have the freedom in his neighborhood to do these things. And you ever remember all the kids had lots of hobbies, not just one hobby, but two hobbies, three hobbies, four hobbies, and their one single working parent in their nuclear family was able to pay for a home that, by the way, probably had a garden out back and all of the other little projects that each family member had. Now, skip forward to now, And we have homeless living literally everywhere on the street. And a good portion of them are not homeless because we don't live in the best, most financial, experiment that's ever the best time in the world, basically, to be alive with the most opportunity. It's not because of that. It's because they wanted to be homeless, a lot of them. There's a portion that just ends up that way because of mental illness, et cetera, et cetera. But the rest of them have realized they can just get a check every month, a universal basic income, and they can sit on the sidewalks. They can not pay any utilities. They can squat on people's private property. They can poop on the sidewalk. They can do drugs all day, and they can get a phone. And, you know, if they need to go to the doctor will see them to keep them alive so that they can keep on doing what they're doing. They don't need to buy property. They can just squat and build tent cities. And you see this in every major city now. And those people are also dependent on the delivery system of the disposable generation, which is now, because we're being disposed of. And they're using this generation to implement that, because they are the ignorant generation that doesn't know how to do anything. They know about gender studies. They know about these new philosophical ideas of Marxism, but they don't know how to run stuff. They're not going to go build the hydroelectric dam that your community needs to have electricity after an asteroid impact, a major volcanic event, an EMP, a nuclear war, you name it. We're screwed, because those are the young people, the disposable generation, I hate to say it, that it's being disposed of. So they're going to be the ones that it's their job to see what they can do with the earth. And I don't have high expectations for them.
Yeah, nor I. You know, it was kind of a disillusionment to walk up into that place, because I saw a sedated population. You know, weed's legal up there. Cool. I believe in that. Do whatever you want to do. But the way it's being used to target people to keep them sedated was what I noticed most. It wasn't about the freedom to be able to, you know, choose the medicine of your choice from plants and plant-based medicines. It was about just getting people high so they forget and they're complacent and they don't want change and they don't even survey the situation, as long as they can get high all day long. It costs pennies. They were giving away samples out on the street. I was shocked, like, hey, man, smoke some of this. If you like it, we got the shop right here. Like, they actually had tables set out offering free fucking smoke right out in front of the places that the vendors, the little shops there. And that was, it was a selected, sedated crew around. You know, it was just, as I saw, I really felt sad that that's what it had come to now, is the sedation of population so they don't move and they don't take action. And they get them back into that, what do you call it, before COVID kind of, it's going to come back. I'll tell you a story. I knew a couple of restaurateurs up there. So, I went to say hey. And we were talking, and we're staying outside. It was coming around like 6 o'clock, and I was like, what time's your busiest time? And he tells me, he goes, man, you know, before COVID, the cars would be lined up around the block just even to park to come into our restaurant. He's like, now look, there's not even a line out of the door tonight. Like, it got it so reduced in the traffic of people coming in. He's like, you know, before, now it's just a barely run even cost on the amount of people coming in. I do hope that it'll come back, but it's going to be years, if not decades, before it comes back to anything normal again. It was just interesting to take a look at how many shops are out of business there. Small shops, mainly mom and pop shops, little grocery stores, the little thrift shop chic, like B-52's style clothing, kind of, you know, thrift shop chic was that whole rage up there. Went down to Greenwich Village, hung out in Soho, did get out to Times Square. You know, mainly spent time in Manhattan because that's where I knew people. But it was just like literally a shell of its former self. Like, we went around Soho. Now, there must have been 25-30% of the businesses just totally taped up, papered over windows. And, you know, the corners are like some of the most valuable space, because you got entrances on both sides of the streets. And I lost count of how many of them were just papered over. They weren't boarded up like it was in COVID, because I talked to them, and they're like, yeah, well, during COVID, they actually put, like, sheet or OSB, like some kind of sheeting over the window so nobody could even go in to go to work. Well, now everything's out of business, so what they do is they have this, like, brown paper that they put inside the windows to, you know, so you can't really look in. But some of them you could, and it was just, and it was this realization that hit me. I felt really kind of sick to my stomach on what's happening with humanity up there. That not of their own choice, but to be forced on them. And just the amount of business that was gone. So where did those people go to? And, you know, I've been in New York before, and I do remember ambulances, but this time it was like ambulance after ambulance after ambulance. There were so many ambulance calls all going to residential buildings. And I'm still wondering if they were pulling people out of there that had died from the backs. Because it was just nonstop crews. Like usually when you would get an ambulance call, you know, you might have a police officer rolling with them or a fire truck. But they were just running amok like the most ambulances I've ever seen. It was like they were little ant carts running around everywhere, pulling people out of their buildings after they died and whatever. And I was just thinking, this is now just a body cleanup operation. They just use the sirens and things. And the whole thing was kind of really surreal. I sat there, you know, just like, I cannot believe it. Because, you know, like you mentioned, as soon as you go outside of those areas to the west, it's all farms. We flew from Tennessee up there. And it was farm, 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 farm. We went over Virginia, farm, 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 farm. And then we came up through New Jersey. But, you know, even west out there, it was all farms. So, you know, the habitation is so tightly squeezed. And I remember Ransom, you had referenced, you know, I think it was in Brazil where they were giving everybody lottery to get these new houses. And you're like, oh, cool. Sounds like spacious neighborhoods. But they were squeezed little ghettos on top of each other with millions and millions of acres of forest free. But they squeezed everybody into these tiny homes inside a ghetto somewhere in the edges of a Brazilian rainforest, which was deforested by McDonald's for their cows to give you cheap slop burgers. I sat there and I was thinking, you know, everything is piled up over on the population centers. If there were some kind of wave event, which we've heard and we saw off of Japan, wink, wink, that would take out, you know, 40 million people. Easily up and down that coast there, if they didn't have enough warning and they couldn't get out of the way of a large generated tsunami, whatever way it's generated. I was thinking, you know, everything is just so completely compacted over there. And the minute you leave that, it's completely open space again. So this homeless number about, oh, there's not enough space on the planet, da, 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 and you can squeeze in, they're lying to you. Just I'll personally say, from my own opinion, they're lying to you. There is so much available space, even from Tennessee through Virginia, up through, like, say, Pennsylvania, over to, you know, even, I wouldn't even say upstate New York, but anywhere going up that direction. As soon as you get outside the habitation centers, it is just massive amounts of open land as far as you can see. Like, I'm on an airplane looking at things that, I understand there's Shenandoah National Park, and there's a few other national parks around, and there's Great Smoky Mountains, but people still live in there. And there was massive amounts of, you know, you got little hamlets and people living on their farms and things, but people complaining. And I look here at these windmill things, and I did see a few of the windmills. Now, for me, we have hawks out on our place, and they try to attack our chickens and sometimes come down for a turkey or two because they're, you know, they like fresh meat. I myself am not able to shoot a hawk. Although I will go to prison for 3 years for shooting a hawk on my own property that's trying to go after my own wildlife or my own birds here. Not allowed. Can't touch the hawks. Can't do it. And the eagles. Yet these windmills are able to chop thousands of bald eagles into little bits and leave them lying on the ground. And nigh a word is said. The amount of eagle deaths and hawk deaths from those massive blades. That's why there's a reduction in population. They might, an animal population, specifically birds. Now, they might squawk all day long like it's human caused, it's human this. Well, you know, it is indirectly. It's corporate caused by erecting 300-foot tall, 200-foot tall windmills up there in known migratory patterns for prey birds. You know, and you go whacking off and chopping eagles to smithereens and wiping out the breeding stock, of course they're going to be, they're more rare now than they were in the 1970s. The only place the eagle still exists is places where there are not windmills. I think it was 20 years in prison if you were caught hunting and actually had harvested a bald eagle and you were in possession of it. There was like a mandatory prison sentence for that. Hands down, plus your house was confiscated, car, everything. They took everything, throw you in prison, and whenever you get out, because you took an eagle. Well, you know, these corporations are not held anywhere remotely close to the same. Because if you're getting hundreds of eagle strikes on your blades out there in single facilities, and they're not shut down, that's a huge problem. And this whole thing about the marketing blitz and you know, the whole thing about New York, too, was it was just the most massive marketing buzz fest overload of buy two, buy one, this is on sale, go to this, take two, take a trip, buy this, do it again. But at the same time, squawking about the Green New Deal, about, oh, you're using too many resources. But they're still spending hundreds of billions of dollars per year on advertising to get you to buy the trinkets of junk. So you can't have both. You either have a society that stops advertising because we need to consume nothing more because we're at the edge of collapse for the 16th time in 30 years, another year, and it's going to, ice caps are going to, oh, the humans, they're going to be extinct if we don't stop the tennis shoe trade. The poor little rubber trees, man. I wish it was a rubber tree. Then I'd be working for Nike. You know, at least rubber trees are guaranteed employment. They're always going to be working for Nike. Thing is, if you're a palm oil tree, you're always working for Nabisco because they always need the palm oil for their junky foods in the boxes that'll make you sick. But the diametrics that we could go through dozens of these tonight, and I'm glad, Ransom, you brought up a few of them, like the massive kill-off of wildlife. Can you imagine being an insect and flying into a solar panel facility that's like 500 acres? Can you imagine the eyes of those insects? They're blinded. Birds as well, just the average bird, not birds of prey, like eagles or hawks, but just any bird that would fly in there, and you know they go in and suddenly, you know, oh, and they can't find their way out. They have thousands of birds die in these facilities every single week. Like, they become dead zones around these areas. If nobody knows, I encourage you to do the research on animal and bird deaths, insect anomalies, declines of bee populations near solar farms or solar panel PV farms. It's just so blinding inside these areas. I mean, the workers in there have to wear specialized eye protection and goggles and shade when they go in there because they can't even get in there to repair without humans being blinded to the point of never seeing again without the proper eye protection. Now, what chance does a bird have who doesn't even know that you shouldn't look at the light? For insects. But no, we got to put this garbage all over the planet. And I just, you know, I'm perplexed, you know, buy two, but oh, we need to save the planet. Well, okay, maybe I'll buy two if it lasts more than 5 seconds after I get it. You pull a pair of shoes and the first time you do, the shoelace breaks. Like, what kind of quality is that? I don't know, Ransom, I'm sure we can think of a few more, man. What else is on the list, do you think?
Actually, just speaking about, you know, you were talking about those animals that are unfortunate to come across these man-made contraptions. There's just so many bad things about them. I mean, for one, in order to keep deluding ourselves into this dream into the future, there has to be a kinetic war with China. Otherwise, we're going to have to start invading countries to get these rare earth elements because we don't have them and we don't have them in production. So either we start strip mining all over the world or we go to war and make some kind of agreement with China where we continue the trade that we have going on. In the backup of this, a lot of people also forget, you know, I've been studying a lot about these wind farms that's just the daytime stuff we talked about. At nighttime, the bats are getting hit by it and, you know, on and on and on. And if you know that if you get rid of these raptors and different birds, they control the pest populations. They control the rodents. They control the snakes. They control the large amounts of insects. So, you know, if you were picturing having a farm-friendly green future with all the new technologies, I'm sorry to tell you, they're incompatible. Not only are they pollutants themselves, but they just kill everything around them. I mean, because they're not supposed to be there. They're not, you know, ergonomically fitting into the environment at all. There is no feng shui with a giant fan in your environment. And not to mention just the, you know, practicality of observing the beauty of nature is interrupted by these monstrosities just on that alone. But if you really think about how bad it can get when you start messing, because think about this. The only humans that have ever successfully just kind of coexisted with the Earth realized that instead of really changing the Earth in these dramatic ways, instead we work with the rhythms. And those cultures seem to fit into their environment perfectly and you know, have civilizations that may have lasted a long time. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here, obviously. But we don't do that anymore. Everything we do is anti-nature. And the same thing is true about the green movement. It's kind of backwards than that. The things that they push for have been co-opted because they won't look into actually the ideas that they're pushing and realize that the global elite, the same people that, you know, they're complaining about and the oil and blah, 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 it's the same people. They have figured out a way to totally control everything and make people pay for breathing you know, I mean, because that's what it is. This is all about an imaginary boogeyman of carbon dioxide that, by the way, none of these machines or programs help with. They end up making more. So if that was the problem, obviously these things are not the answer. But think about how man now fits into its environment by changing it so dramatically that several species will die off, causing a vacuum for other species. And a lot of time those are not beneficial species. So in order to just have like, you know, a farm forest area that is functioning in a healthy way, you kind of need all of these animals in their different niches to just be there. So the only way that we're ever going to go into the future and, you know, coexist in a green way that these guys are imagining is that you actually live with nature. And that doesn't mean that you can't use technology in it. You use technology to help nature when possible, just like the ideas of permaculture. Find out what nature's doing and help it. And then you get these monstrosities like the things that are killing the bats, which means there's going to be more bugs, which eats more crops. And then you have the, you know, the raptor birds, the owls at night. And then you got the raptor birds in the daytime, and they're not eating as many little varmints that they used to eat, increasing the population. And the same thing has happened with the wolves. You know, all of these, every time that man changes or removes a species, we mess up the whole thing, and it has to come to a new balance. And that new balance isn't necessarily positive, you know, for the conditions of living as a man on the earth, or as a human being, excuse me. And it seems like, you know, they know that. That's why they've created this disposable reset right here. And they don't care what happens in the wake. They don't care how many people die. They don't care how long they pollute the earth. All that matters to them is that they control what there is. And I guess they figure it's a good enough cost, you know, benefit that they are going to benefit by getting rid of everybody that lives out in these beautiful nature areas, because we've seen their plans and Agenda 2030 and et cetera and on and on. In order to get there to the place that they want to be, which is this feudalist transhuman nightmare where the regular population is stuck in, you know, super cities, which means that they'll be at the same, you know, ignorance as some of the people that live in the city in the era right now. So this new era that they want to build is where everybody's cram packed in there. They control who has children. They control who does what. You're tracked totally all the time. Every product that you buy, every place that you go, every person that you talk to, literally with technology that can read your mind. And they want to become one with the, you know, the machinery has to be one with the people. And then outside of that, you get these rich guys, rich families, these elites' children and or the new wealth of new corporations, and they're all living out there in their super tech armored redoubts in the middle of nature because they've litigated and legislated everyone off of the king's land, and then we go back to the Sheriff of Nottingham idea, where if you get caught killing a deer or something like that to eat it. Not the way that they do it, where they destroy entire ecozones, but just going out and living as a natural living man in the wild and eating a deer or a rabbit or whatever else you come up with, because times are like that. If you don't want to live in the super city, you'll be arrested. You'll be killed. You'll be rounded up and imprisoned. And all of these things have been being practiced right in front of us. And, I was watching an interesting speech at the UN where they were talking about their research into recent events, i.e. what happened to the world in the last couple of years, and these plans and scenarios that they had all the way back into the 1960s. And here we are at the time, and that was just like one of the first steps in pulling the plug on today's civilization. Next will be the money, the food, and then your peaceful life on Earth, as far as living here without worrying about governments fighting each other for resources and control over who gets those resources. And then let's get to the topic of tonight. With all of that going on the ground, the end of civilization really is more at risk from some random object just popping the surface of the Earth, or a succession of volcanoes, maybe because the Earth is charged in a certain way that goes off. And right now, down in Mexico, Popo is popping its top. And once again, millions of people are at risk to having a scenario kind of like Vesuvius and Pompeii, where their whole civilization there gets covered in ash. And that is the biggest city in the world, ironically, right now. And they have a bunch of troops right now ready to evacuate. There's ash on Puebla, the city that's right next to it, which is part of the greater metropolis of Mexico City. And then you get into this weird coincidence that if you just take a second and look around the world at all of the major metropolises, they just so happen to be on some kind of natural disaster zone for the most part. You can just look around the world. There's either a volcano, they built it on a fault, they're in a hurricane zone, they got tornadoes. Like, whose idea was it to build Dallas, Fort Worth, and Houston in areas that get hit constantly by disturbances? Why would they do that? Unless, from the beginning, the planners planning already knew that this phase of civilization was just a disposable version for their ultimate goal, which they've wrote about since the early 20s, at least their progressive views on how they can use eugenics and technology to form and shape the future of mankind going forward.
Yeah, I would agree on that. When we take a look at the amount of volcanoes going off right this second, Mexico City and then Etna today, and Chivalush and Bismiani, the sulfur dioxide still continues to spin around the planet, cooling ground surface temperatures. And scientists are baffled why. Gee, they don't want to put the correlation of sulfur dioxide can cool temperatures, and it already is, because they want to take credit for that. So as we march forward, I could believe that with all the volcanoes going off, they're going to start to admit more publicly that they're doing geoengineering programs to take credit for the cooling that's occurring naturally. Because I always knew this was going to be baked in the cake eventually. When we come into this grand solar minimum, weather patterns are changing, cloud cells and jet streams are in new places, that the Earth was going to begin to cool in some regions. Now, I would encourage you, anybody out there, to go to Tropical Tidbits. And Ransom, this would be a great graphic, so let me see if I can talk at the same time. And it's tropicaltidbits.com. If you go to the forecast models, what you want to do on the left side, there's something that says thermodynamics. That means heat. And you want to go down to the 2-meter temperature anomaly. And it'll bring you up this map that has reds, blues, and purples on it. Then you want to click over into the regions section, and you're going to go with all these maps. Just scroll to the bottom and go to the world. And as you do, I would like you to focus on the southern hemisphere and go way down to Antarctica. And wow, as I'm looking for the next month, it is 30 degrees Celsius below the normal temperature.
So Ransom, which one did you say to click to on?
I'll have it open real quick and see if you can open this up.
Okay.
You want to click on thermodynamics. After you go to tropical tidbits, you go to the forecast models. I just sent it to you there. GFS model. Just sent that to you in Skype. And when you go on to that forecast model, up at the top section there, there's a little tab, forecast models. And then you want to go to the thermodynamics. That's a super important thermodynamics. Then you want to go to 2 meter temperature anomaly, which for English speakers is the ground temperature at 6 feet, how much warmer it is or how much cooler it is than the normal on the last 30-year average. And then it'll bring you up to a bunch of maps. If you take them down, then you go down to the world map. And if you focus on Antarctica, and you can take that little slider bar and keep it moving forward, June 4th, June 5th, June 6th, June 7th, June 8th, all I see is 25, 30 Celsius below normal across Antarctica as far as the eye can see for as far as this forecast goes out with GFS model. This was forecast anyway with the Hunga Tonga eruption and all the extra water vapor in the southern hemisphere blocking sunlight. In addition, ozone breaks down faster when it's colder. So the breakdown of ozone higher in the atmosphere just doesn't occur because it lands on an ice crystal surface. It has to have extreme cold before that chemical process can really actuate. And for those of you, I've said it before, you know, the O3 molecule is ozone. It's three oxygen atoms bound together as one molecule, and it's O3, not O2, like the gas we breathe. That's why some people use ozone generators, because there's an extra oxygen atom bound to that. So when that lands on an ice crystal way high in the mesosphere, say 35 or 40 miles above your head, sometimes it just won't break down because the temperatures are not cool enough. You might have every other condition correct, but the temperatures are not low enough for it to happen. But what I'm looking down here in the whole southern portion of our globe is, you know, I've never seen this before. It's pegged off the chart of cold at 30 Celsius below normal across a huge swath of Antarctica. I mean, like 75% of the continent is 20 to 30 Celsius below the averages. And this is way early. It's not even winter yet. I can't even imagine what the temperatures will be. They're just barely coming into fall down there, just like we're barely coming out of spring and into summer. Remember, the southern hemisphere is the opposite. So we're just coming into, you know, the end of spring here, finally getting into the very beginning cusp of what some might consider summer. At the end of spring, well, they're just coming into the fall, like the very beginning of fall, you know. I think somewhere like in the middle of September, or for us here in the northern hemisphere, the temperatures are starting to cool down in the evenings. By the time we get to the middle of September, you notice that, you know, it's pretty much, you know, you're entering a different season. Like, these types of temperatures should not be seen for months and months and months from now. They're having middle of the winter temperatures right now in the early part of the fall. So what this tells me is two things: that there's absolute effects from volcanic eruptions happening down over Antarctica. The water coming out of the atmosphere is drenching Australia and parts of the equator more than others. And the ice crystal clouds are going to break down. And, you know, as I was listening to you there talk a bit, I just wanted to go on to my, I had to use Bing for the, not Bing, but what's that one in the Microsoft with the little circle there? If I open a link in a different tab, Bing, yeah, it takes me over to this different search engine, which I unfortunately had saved my ozone data, my ozone map data from NASA in there. And MSN was kind enough to leave me a bunch of articles. And here was one of them. I kid you not. Scientists are getting kind of anxious about a pothole in space. And what is it talking about? Suddenly, there is a opening over the southern ozone hole that's unexpected, and they can't really believe why it's happening, and they're perplexed. Did I not say many a show that they're going to be perplexed as to how this ozone hole is? They're trying to blame it on the magnetic field of the planet. not anything to do with water vapor. Because that would tell me and you that, whoa, you know, NASA, you knew this water vapor eruption after the Hunga Tonga eruption, what, a year and a half ago? A year and 4 months, and you didn't tell everybody? You kept it a secret, and now you're trying to blame the magnetic field for the breakdown in ozone? Oh, I get it. I get it. And then here was another one that came off that same feed. The Earth is spinning too quickly. The clocks can't keep up. The speed of the Earth's rotation has sped up, and the length of an astronomical day is now off. Like, what? How is that? Like, all these things are starting to happen, but they're trying to explain them away. And here's another electromagnetic one for anybody out there. Here's a new one. Why does Jupiter change its stripes? Scientists say they may finally have an answer. You know why? Because the stripes on Jupiter are changing again, because the electromagnetism across the solar system is now going into another different phase. So you can't tell me that the stripes on Jupiter are now shifting and changing again. At the same time, there's a magnetic anomaly on the planet here that they're trying to blame for the breakdown in the ozone and the ozone column not being there. And it's all happening in conjunction. And the Earth's spinning faster because the astronomical day is off now. All three of these things have just happened in this last, say, 2 to 3 weeks. Kind of quirky how, you know, it's suddenly coming out. But something inbound this way comes. So, Ransom, I'm not on the live feed here for Rumble. I've been looking for these news stories. Did you find the Southern Hemisphere temperature maps? I sent you the link.
Yeah, I was showing it while you were talking there. Here it is.
That is so rare, so unbelievable, so far out. Is it, like, you know, everybody always talks about the Six Sigma event as so many orders of magnitude above anything normal. What we're seeing here with all this hype about global warming, and we got the coldest temperatures pretty much ever seen in Antarctica this early in the year ever. Not just once, but twice, but it's the consistent now that something has run away and broken. But I don't know. Here we sit at the end of the year. It's going to be a catastrophic ozone depletion event. So I talked about this last week. Just get ready for it. There's going to be a lot of crop losses, insects, crazy sea life. And I was asking a friend of mine who lives in New Zealand, can you send me some articles in your New Zealand news that show something that's off? So let me see if I can pull it here. I'm trying to go through my feed real quick. But he ended up sending me a couple stories about sea life not behaving correctly down under, if you will. It was actually in New Zealand. And, oh, yeah, are New Zealand's marine heat waves a warning to the world? So what they're trying to say is that winter's already arriving in New Zealand. This is another headline he sent me last week. Winter arrives early in New Zealand. They got record snow, unbelievable amounts of snow in New Zealand already. And if I crack this one open, the seas around Aotearoa are heating at an unparalleled rate, so all the sea life's being affected. Things are beaching themselves. Fish strandings, they're trying to say that all these fish strandings happening across New Zealand are because of warm waters from global warming. When I was asking my friend down there, William, I was like, hey, can you find me all these kind of articles that are talking about strange sea life behavior? Because that would be one of the things, if the UVB gets stronger and the magnetic field starts to tweak a bit, is sea life's going to be really affected. And lo and behold, there's a story after story of fish strandings, whale strandings, dolphin strandings. Just things behaving strangely, fish jumping out of the water and beaching themselves, just kind of weird things, you know? So anyway, sorry to cut you off there, but that was kind of the end of my rant.
Well, I think that maybe the good thing is if our magnetic field is doing that, we're going to be getting more incoming particles charging, you know, the magnetic field closer to the Earth, which I believe that's directly connected to the amount of lightning strikes that happens. You know, I'm no scientist, but the more lightning strikes happen, then you start getting a buildup of ozone. And it makes me wonder if those two phenomena are connected, where, you know, when this happens, where the magnetic field starts to collapse, or you might get holes in the ozone, does the Earth kind of necessarily start repairing itself with increased lightning strikes around the world? I don't know that. That was just a question I'm asking. But, you know, it is bizarre that, I mean, I guess it's not bizarre. It's just bizarre because we live in these times, but having all of these things potentially happening in our lifetime. And then I kind of go back to the generational thing because, you know, I grew up reading Omni and Popular Mechanics and all of this stuff, talking about all of these ideas and what I thought was the distant future, reading all about volcanoes and impact strikes and bolides and asteroids and et cetera. And one thing that is, you know, obvious is eventually one of these things is going to happen. You know, and I, when you're a kid, you just put these things back in the back of your mind, you know, like anything else. It's nothing you can control. And we're still in that position as adults. The only thing is now I'm realizing that I may get to see one of these things I read about as a kid happening in real time in my lifetime, which will be something to behold, I imagine. So, you know, just looking at the Popo, I'm not going to try to say the whole name, but the Popo there in Mexico City or near it, I got a chance recently to visit that area. And it brings, you know, to mind the idea that you have the city of Teotihuacan there and unknown people that were building that city before the Mayans, like 100 years or so or more before the Mayans laid the first brick of any of their cities. Somebody lived there. They call them the Teotihuacanos. At first, they said it was the Aztec. Well, the Aztec came in and found it and gave it a name. The Mayans didn't build it. So there's this mystery people that built it. And, you know, they didn't even uncover most of it until like 1806. It was completely covered in sediment, mud, maybe even volcanic ash. Who knows? They cleaned it away. I don't know if they did a study about what the material was made of. But lo and behold, when they got down to the bottom, they find this miraculous city that has been repaired several times and a giant pyramid that directly is prominently talking about the solar system, the sun in particular, and the cycles there. And this thing has, you know, I don't know, five, I think, pyramids inside of it. And the more you go inside, the more megalithic it becomes. In fact, the Temple of Quetzalcoatl, which I usually associate with, I think is something that people not only saw in the sky, but happened at the same time as other things, as a lot of myths get started. This is supposed to be a feathered serpent in the sky that came down from the sky and one idea of it. And I'm thinking, you know, that could have been reference to some kind of bolide hit at that time, talking about stuff. But you go back to what looks like a megalithic city that goes back even further than they're giving it credit for there. And it's a whole complex dedicated to the sun, not unlike all of the other megalithic builders around the world that, in my opinion, are pre-diluvian remnants of a more technological advanced civilization than we've ever given anybody in the past credit for, obviously, by looking at what they made. And you get all of these temples. They're all dedicated to the sun, which means that the people then, and keep in mind that these people most likely had this 52,000-year calendar or at least reference to it. So they have the information about cycles. And I would imagine that every so often within this cycle, Earth is in a vulnerable position. And when that happens, events happen. So I don't think it's an accident that these things, and it's ironic that that same volcano is taking out the same area that it did in the past. So this was a big civilization that lived at Teotihuacan, and it's just a little bit north, I think, of the volcano. Completely covered, gone before any of these people you hear about when you're hearing about the American cultures, you know, the Mayans, et cetera, the Toltecs and the Aztecs. Before all of that, there was a big city there. We know that. It was dedicated something to do with the sun and what was going on. Why they built it right next to a volcano kind of makes you wonder, because, you know, a lot of ancient...
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Hello, my name is is Mr. Rowe. I am the host of Reality Extraction. On Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday, 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
The original machine had a base plate of prefamulated amulite surmounted by a malleable logarithmic casing, in such a way that the two spurving bearings were in a direct line with a panometric fan. The lineup consisted simply of six hydrocoptic Marzal vanes, so fitted to the ambifacient lunar wane shaft that side fumbling was effectively prevented. The main winding was of the normal lotus O deltoid type, placed in panendermic semi-boloid slots of the stator, every seventh conductor being connected by a non-reversible tremie pipe to the differential girdle spring on the up end of the gram meters.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio, taking the confusion out of transmutated lunar girdle springs for 4 years and running. Revolution Radio, the number one listener-supported alternative media radio on the planet.
I want to thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio!
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio, Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
And welcome back to the second hour of Midnight Stage Conversation. I'm your host, Freddie Long, here with Ransom Godwin. As always, taking you through 2 hours of conversation.
All right. Thanks for listening. Why don't we take a short break here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com. Now we're going to get back to your host.
Look at the past and possibilities of solution right now in this world that we're living in. You know, most of it is going to be distraction because all the natural events are more scary for governments to control people and keep them in line until the event happens. But what's the best way? The carrot and the stick. We have all these volcanoes erupting. And just before we went on the break, I went to one of my favorite sites, watchers.news. And that's watchers.news. And what it is, it's a consolidator site for extreme events. Now, most times they're focused on huge fireballs, huge hail, earthquakes, volcanoes, and anything strange like massive floods. Otherwise, you have to go somewhere else. If you're into this type of news, this is the site for you. It's absolutely one of my favorites. I check it every day, or at least every other day, to see if anything new is popping off around the planet. And we forgot before the break to talk about the Democratic People's Republic of the Congo. Remember, there was quite the large eruption about 2 years ago. Was that Naima Lugira volcano, another one, super volcano, one of the largest in Africa. And it's firing off where you can see the red emissions from 60 miles away. So lava's coming down that one. Colombia, there's a huge amount of volcanoes going off around the planet right now. Again, we come into what I call these earthquake and volcanic windows. And it's going to get more intense until it just stays at an amplified stage, which I believe would be as we come around the sun this final time into 2024, when the second magnetic field really starts to get intense, as the four gas giants line up into their square, October of 2024. Here's really the how I feel this moves along. And Revolution Radio, thank you for letting us talk about this tonight. As hard as I've tried over all these years, my YouTube channel really took off when I first started talking about these. And because I kept talking against global warming and pointing out the hypocrisy and everything, my channel really hasn't grown. You know, even though I've switched over to a lot of talking about economy on how this dovetails into the economy, economic effects of the food pricing and different things along with the food economy and the climate, but they still didn't let me off the naughty list. I wish somebody would buy YouTube and then release it like Elon did, and then I bet my channel will start flying again. And I should get the back pay also for YouTube revenue that you stole for 6 years while you pushed this channel back and throttled the information flow. But we can talk here in Revolution Radio. Thank you. And Rumble. Yay. So as we come into this magnetic anomaly, what you're seeing now with the amplified effects of all these volcanoes and earthquakes ticking off everywhere, that's going to be the average state of it, and it's going to increase another one or two steps up from here. So what we're seeing right now is, in my opinion, probably the least amount of volcanoes erupting at any one time that we'll ever see on the planet for the next 4 years. And volcanoes and earthquakes go hand in hand. At some point around October of 2024, it's very possible every single volcano on the planet is going to erupt at the same time. This makes sense. If you look further back in time with the global liquefaction event, and otherwise, others have done a huge amount of research on something called a mud flood. Now, again, the more credence there is to ancient history, look at the more mainstream media try to label it as a conspiracy theory or hocus pocus or a bunch of dudes living in their basement or with their parents' house that are doing research. This makes the most sense for me. Because if we come into this amplified event where every volcano or most of them are going off and we got earthquakes everywhere, you're going to have liquefaction events going on. And this would explain why at least a quarter, 25% of the entire world was buried in mud between 10 and 30 feet deep across a good 25% of the entire Earth's surface. This is why those researchers that are into the mud flood or global liquefaction event, I'm not talking about Tartaria, I'm just really going back about 400 years. Why did they knock door entrance ways into the second floor? And now with our modern excavation equipment, we can tear away the soil and the earth, and then we find an entire floor underneath that, or two. I mean, you got to realize back then they didn't have excavation equipment. So if there was a city there, much like Mexico City, and it was buried up, Because one thing as a kid, you know, taking history lessons, which we used to learn about history in school, I was always taught they would build on top of the previous, you know, city. And I kept thinking, why? How could you do that? If there's already a building there, how do you build on top of it? Is one of my questions, but I never got a logical answer. Except that they built on top of it. And I'm like, well, wait, you have to tear the building down to build on top of it. No, they just built on top. And you get all these cultural layers and things. All right, well, how do you do that? If indeed this cycle, every 400 years, comes back and throws a liquefaction event onto the planet and a portion of it gets buried, Ransom, I'm going to answer your question. Why don't they want to repair any of these bridges or roadways or whatever it is, and they've let it rot into oblivion for the last 50 years? They can't. They're not going to. If I'm predicting a global liquefaction event as early as October 2024, imagine if you had the data and you knew for a fact where it would be most heavily influenced. You would not repair the infrastructure. Why would you? You would just let it go knowing that it would be destroyed and covered in mud or whatever kind of sand or sand, water, mud mix, whatever. There's a huge amount of combinations of what the earth can throw at us in terms of liquid movement of what you consider muds and dirts and sands and clays. And rock. You ever watch those videos that come down when landslides come down? It's like the entire mountain turned into liquid and it's just rolling down. It looks no different than a river does, but it's of rock. And you're just like, how did it all chip into that small thing? Keep rolling down the earth's so magnificent. And you know, we are only on the very surface of the crust. Now, the crust will go down at least. The research I've done and more researchers that have done more research than me about this liquefaction event, it's usually just the top 1 mile or 2 miles of the crust are affected electromagnetically. But then going into a little bit deeper research, back to the story of Noah. You know, the story of Noah is the water exploded out from the ground from beneath and came out of the crust as well as from the firmament down. But lo and behold, there's three times more water in the crust of our planet than there is for every ocean, every river, every lake on the planet's surface. There's 3x more under the planet. So that makes total sense. Now, if we get into some sort of electromagnetic activity, all these volcanoes are going off. Obviously, some of those are going to tap into that water and start throwing things out of the cone. Because Easter Island's a perfect example. If you look at Easter Island, higher up where the statues were, they're buried up to the neck. The further you get toward the coast, they're more buried up to the belly. Easter Island's like the most perfect example of a mud flood that can ever be given in textbook perfection of. Where the emanation is buries deeper than further afield, which makes sense why some buildings were buried 3 floors deep and other buildings were buried 1 floor deep. But irregardless, they had to knock in a new entrance and create a door in the second floor window. So common around the planet, it's more common than it's not common. See, that's an unusual thing about it. But of course, when you start to point these things out and you map it out with a timeline, and it makes much more sense as cyclic nature, and I'll bring you back to the beginning of the program. Everything we're seeing now is a distraction because I just can't see the governments of the world, as inept as they are, to come this full circle to be able to control every human being on the planet when the central bank digital currencies failed at rollout in Nigeria. To be able to track and trace every human to that point and put them in human zoos and control them to the Uber where every thought, every whisper, every hush, it's totally controlled. And then what? I keep coming back. And then what? Okay, they accomplished their goal. And then? Or is that the distraction because all these naturally events are coming in? Because remember, the people who are focused on the CBDCs, the track and trace, the chip, the social credit score, those are the 10% of the aware and awake people on the planet. The other 90% are already sheep that will be sheep as long as they live. No need to even try to disguise anything from the sheep. Doesn't even matter. It won't even work. Who cares? They're going to be sheep forever. The real programming, no pun intended, with CBDC's programmable money, is to program the aware and the awake's minds to avoid, oh, they'll look up and there'll be bullheads rolling through our atmosphere. You were distracted by the CBDCs. when the most bolides in sky and in space debris came ripping into our planet in the last 2,000 years. Yeah, you were distracted with CBDCs. Oh, hey, look over there. Here comes inbound asteroids. Ransom. I know that was a lot to digest in the first momento, but it does seem like a huge amount of volcanoes are going off, especially the Democratic People's Republic of Congo. You got places all over South America. You got things in Asia. It's just going off everywhere at the moment. I think it's going to increase, just thinking out loud.
Well, it may indeed increase. You know, I kind of said that we might be on the verge of that, or at least I hope I said might or could be, because, you know, we could go another 1,000 years on geologic terms without any major thing happening. However, it does seem like we're right at the vulnerable point in history and cycles where these things do happen. You know, and the reason I brought up 536 AD is just for that reason. Something happened. And there are theories, and it's kind of backed up by the Greenland ice sheet, that there are cosmogenic particles in the layer of ash and things that were going on. So we're pretty sure that there were volcanoes going off in Europe, Southeast Asia, the Americas, maybe even more. And these were all going off at the same time, and it just created a dark, crazy time period in Earth's history, where places in China were losing 80% of the population, things like that, all over the world, disease, darkness, no farms were being grown. And something like this could happen today. It could happen, and it may indeed happen. But if it happens, what does that look like for today's world? And that's kind of where I was going when I brought up that we're kind of in the disposable generation. And everything that you see, from infrastructure to the minds of the general public, seems to be put in that position of disposable. Like nothing's designed to really withstand anything. And it seems like really what we're doing right now, as far as a civilization, is getting out all the beta programs for after the next something that sets humans back, because we know that they happen. It doesn't matter if you're talking about volcanoes or bolides or, you know, the things hitting the earth or even things like that. And, you know, you were talking a little bit about Noah's Ark and how the water may have come. It seems like, you know, we did literally have a worldwide flood. There's kind of no real argument in that. Almost every civilization on Earth and not only prehistory, so to speak, like when you're talking about the Sumerians and their cuneiform writings, the Epic of Gilgamesh and everything like that. We have all these stories of this great flood, and it fits in right at the time period we think that these impacts may have happened in the Younger Dryas. So again, there's a cosmogenic, portion of this story that happens each time, it seems like. So if you're talking about 536 AD or all the way back to, you know, the dinosaurs going extinct, no matter what it is, it seems like, you know, there's a certain time that, whether or not the planet is charged or the sun is charged or what it is that's going on, that these things whip in and go nearby or pull on the earth or impact the earth. And it causes a domino effect of things to happen. So let's think about the Younger Dryas. We're in an ice age. All of a sudden, it seems like some bolides may have hit in the Americas, maybe even blowing up above it, or some of them impacting, melting these massive glaciers and ice sheets. And then afterwards, there are papers about how, you know, with all of the flooding that would have been coming off the mainland of these things melting, and the disposition of the ice and water and mud, rocks, boulders, etc., pouring off into the Atlantic Ocean, there might have triggered a kind of like the recycle emblem of tsunamis bouncing back and forth in between the Americas, Africa, and Europe. And if you imagine this going on at that time, it would have seemed like a worldwide flood. So, boom, it seems like the water's coming from below the ground off the coast, and it's just coming up on ground, and it's flooding everything, and shit's being knocked down, stuff's being knocked down, excuse me. And then days later, it happens again, because this massive amount of energy is finding some place to equalize, and it's going back and forth. So it looks like there may have been a massive tsunami coming off the Americas that hit the European areas and African regions, which bounced back off of those continents, sending off another tsunami back at the Americas. So this might have happened back and forth there, and it's connected to cosmogenic material. So we think something might have hit the Earth. And if you think about the amount of kinetic energy of the oceans banging against the continents there in these massive tsunamis, you could think that that might trigger some kind of, cracking or displacement of the land itself, aside from earthquakes or anything like that, just the movement of this massive kinetic energy going back and forth. And then also the erosion effects that would have happened. So all of these, and then you got to remember all of this area that was exposed, that was above the ocean in those time periods, no longer there. Which, so you can think about massive amounts of areas where human beings lived in those times, just gone. One day it's there, next day it's an ocean, because all of this, new water is. Now, we're in a unique situation now where there's no ice caps. There's not a massive amount of water to worry about that kind of worldwide global flooding. However, if a bolide were to hit today, we would be looking at something more like massive winters, which may cause, ice buildup and stuff. And think about that. Any of these things that happen, whether it's a volcano, whether it's an impact or a giant earthquake, the main destructive force seems to be this massive wall of water that moves around in a tsunami form. And you were talking about mud floods and stuff. There's a lot of evidence that the city of Pumapunku and Tihuatanco were just there one day at the edge of a giant lake, and then the next minute it was the lake pushing over all of their civilization there, just knocking it right over. And you can go there today, and there's these giant mud pillars that stand with these giant megalithic blocks still sitting on top of it, where you can see that the massive amount of force of water, mud, and things moving along just knocked out an entire civilization that was built there. And we're not talking about a disposable civilization like today. We're talking about megalithic blocks that were seemingly designed to withstand massive earthquakes and things, and they got knocked down and moved out of the way like toys. So now think about today's infrastructure on any one of these events. And keep in mind, like I said, a lot of the major metropolises of the world and seaports, things that have to do with the economy and feeding the world, are built on natural disaster zones, and they're built with the technology of disposable. So, when you look at our highway systems and you look at our electrical grid, it's all disposable because they don't get paid to make things that last. They get paid to make new things, repair things, replace things. And that's always been the way that kind of civilization has been heading since technology. And you can see that they don't care to lose things because they can build new for cheaper. And it's the same reason that the green people get mad when they really look into the recycling world and realize that to recycle some things would destroy the earth more than it would be just to make new ones. So they make new ones, and the cost is completely different. So that's why you can get a bottle of water somewhere, because it's cheaper to bring you a bottle of water from somewhere else in the other part of the country or the other part of the world, than it is to set up infrastructure for you to just have water where you're at no cost to you. You think about the irony of that, and we're going into the future with this idea of carbon dioxide destroying the planet and all of these ideas to make you pay for that in some way, form or fashion, which is basically a tax on breathing. It's a tax on existing, and that's what they're trying to do. That'll be part of the new reset that comes about. And yes, I don't think that they care at any infrastructure around the world. Think about the continuity of government. They've already taken care of their self. So whenever you think about this just-in-time system that they built, that can be destroyed at a moment's notice by any kind of, either war or natural phenomenon, that it's cheaper for them to just wait, let all of the, people die, let everything be destroyed, pop out, rebuild. It's cheaper. It's the perfect great reset. And that's exactly what they're doing right now, is they're playing out all of their little scenarios on the public of 8 billion people now, of their beta programs of mind control, depopulation, and et cetera. And that's the time we're living in. But sooner or later, the beta programs are going to come to a conclusion. and the grace reset has to happen. And in order to do that, just like any computer system or any system, you have to shut it down completely before you reboot it, restart it, or reset it.
That brings up an interesting set of thoughts there, doesn't it? If you look at construction techniques, based on where we sit in the Ice Age cycle, it would be nothing more than setting up a quick something made from wood and plywood just to have, like, somewhere just almost instantaneously that you could put up that you know would be disassembled and moved or just left there, burned, destroyed, whatever, as you moved on for something more permanent, like a way station. All right, we need to set something up for 2 weeks here. Let's just, you know, put up four walls and put a latrine there or something. It's the same way, because you have to think, if we were coming into the Ice Age cycle in the beginning of it, you would start to build things like, excuse me, Pumapunku or Baalbek or anywhere, where these megalithic blocks are weighing thousands of tons, because you would want it to last as the bedrock of literally the civilization for 50,000 years, because you have that much longer to go through this the cycle. So think about a constructor. If you knew you were going to run the next new 100,000-year cycle and, you know, you're going to get into the depths of the Ice Age, okay, climate stabilizes. All right, great, we've got 70,000 years of stable climate. Let's build something out of stone that will last 70,000 years. Those 2,000-ton blocks are still as the day they were carved, and that was several thousand years prior. But, you know, what would they look like 70,000 years after being carved? Yeah, they'd have some wear and tear and some erosion on it, depending on how many times the different monsoons patterns had shifted, you know, every 4,000 years. Talk about the water erosion on the Sphinx. Yeah, you know, a huge amount of different displacement. The African Mega Lakes is a big one, you know, 6,000 years ago. A huge amount of northern Africa was underwater, freshwater, like Great Lakes in America, and the border of Canada up there. Vast systems, just like the St. Lawrence Seaway, you know, all the way from the Atlantic Ocean all the way into Central Africa was one just giant series of mega lakes controlled by the Ghana Kingdom. And you start to think about, okay, the gold trade was there, the salt trade was there, you know, there's a huge amount, you got massive amounts of animals, you got huge forests covering the show up there. And then you got, of course, water erosion on the Sphinx. So to say that the pyramids were built 4,000 years ago or some garbage like this, when you got the water erosion on the Sphinx, and the only last time that that could have been the earliest, you know, would have been, you know, somewhere between 6 and 15,000 years ago, give or take, because it was starting to dry out at around the 6,000-year period. So you have to go further back, somewhere around 12,000 years before you get into a lot of rainfall. That changed the climate, you know? So you start to look at these vast shifts. That would have done that seven times. So if you were let's say you're off planet MC, you come down here, you're on the planet. All right, we have the technology to melt stone and morph it and mold it. But at the same time, while that process, it's weightless. So it doesn't matter the size because there's no weight with it. Now, it's just how big can the mold be made? Because with the electrogravitics or anti-gravity technologies in the same time of the pouring and molding process, if the block weighs 2,000 pounds, big whoop, we'll make 1,000 of them and we'll build our own temples to ourselves, the gods, because they knew it would last 70,000 years. But now we come into this last 2,000 years, 3,000 years, whatever, we're slipping back into an ice age. Now it's not going to happen tomorrow. But we are at the end of this interglacial period. You can see why there's an all-out fire sale with the civilization, the quality of civilization, the education of the civilization. Everything that we're seeing currently unfold is at the end of an interglacial. Now, this reset in itself is control of the masses, transference of wealth. And I will say one thing, you know, I'm a fan of art. So I was... when I was in New York City, I took a day off to go look at the Ancient History Museum. And there was also at a private residence that was from the German embassy. They also had Austrian and German art in the second and third floor of this private residence. I kid you not, both places were closed because they were, quote unquote, remodeling the buildings and replacing the collections. And when I say replace the collection, the entire buildings were stripped. Everything was gone. So for me, you know, the Met was pretty close. That's a Metropolitan Museum of Art. Now that's right across, you know, like two side streets away, and you get into these smaller museums, which I really believe is where the real information is kept. You know, that over there, that's for the masses. The Met, that's for the masses. The real people doing research and looking for that are at the private collections of residences or at the very small museums that, you know, you can only find, not even in guidebooks, but you have to actually go on the internet and look through like clubs that are involved with ancient history, and then they'll tell you where these museums are. And then I went up to the Met, and they told me one part, this wing was closed, this one part was closed, and I said, why is it closed? It's like the middle of a wing. Oh, well, they're remodeling and they're starting to replace. And we went into some other areas up in the artistic areas, up in the Van Gogh collection area. I kid you not, it was closed. Why was it closed? They were replacing the art. You know what's happening? They're removing all of it out of New York City right now. That is the only conclusion I could think of, is the real artifacts are being moved out of New York City right now. I mean, with all the business closures and everything else, okay. But it just didn't make sense why all the remodeling was. The same excuses were given for every single place. Oh, it's remodeling. They're replacing the art. We'll be open in October again, is what I was told. The dates. Everything's gone now. Everything's going to be replaced. All the remodeling, reconstruction, and the reopening will happen in October of this year. I was thinking, that's really coincidental. To move all the art out all at the same time, what's going on there? Because again, if you were at the end of the civilization time frame, you would not build anything to last. It wouldn't make a difference anyway. You're coming into the cataclysm phase at the end of an interglacial. And, you know, one of the crazy thoughts, Ransom, when you were talking last time was, you know, what is this Rubik's Cube of possibilities of land masses being above or below water? How deep or how shallow are they? And how much crust has been uplifted or downplaced? And how many degrees has the Earth shifted on the pole in itself? Now, think about that combination alone of what we're missing on the planet. Like recreational scuba divers, 130 feet, maybe, if you're doing nitrox. But by most accounts, all the ancient cities are at 400 feet. Like there's no recreational divers down there. And I don't know many people that are pulling side-scanning radar or sonar behind their boats on the weekends, water skiing. Most of them, our ancient history is buried at that depth. Now, if you go over into places, say, Micronesia, you're going to find some things that are at 120 feet. But those are completely encrusted in corals. I mean, Yonaguni, that's a little bit different one because the currents are so strong there that nothing has a chance to really latch on, like corals in calmer waters. We got to think about all these island chains, like in the Philippines and down off of Indonesia and different areas that have really calm water. Anything that would have been there as part of an ancient remnant over 6,000 years, that's a coral reef now. You would have to blast through it or actually do some kind of penetrating radar to actually find the outlines of the prior buildings slash temples. It would be completely encrusted in coral, some, you know, 50, 100 feet thick by that point. So things rising above the oceans and things sinking beneath the oceans. And then you got to twist the planet on how many degrees of tilt would it occur. How much mud had flowed down from the mountains and buried things that were coastal or in estuaries that are now, you know, sunken even further. What kind of land masses that were near lakes, such as think about how many cities along our Great Lakes here in the United States and Canada. If that were to shift, and those lakes subsided further, those whole areas would be mud flats. How much of it, of the buildings, are there still around that we just can't get to or we don't know they're there because geology has covered it up? And that's what these rulers are counting on, the scrubbing of a prior civilization, because they know the cycles of earth cataclysm. But he also hit the real, really very most important point about cost-benefit analysis. Like they're going to, let's go back to Roman era for a second here. And you understood that there was only 2,000 years left in this cycle before we exited and we headed into a new glacial cycle. 2,000 years is a long time. So you're going to build some things to last. They're not going to be built in the megalithic way, but they'll be built with pretty good quality to survive through 1,000 years, because the rulers, they're going to want to keep their opulence, and they're always going to want to have nice quarters for living. But as we get into this day and this time, there is nothing of quality. You know, around New York City, all the buildings are glass, they're reflective, but a major earthquake there and all that glass is going to come screaming down, and it won't take too long for those iron beams to rust into nothing. The only thing that might be left is maybe some of those bridge stanchions or the underpinnings of a highway system, of an 8-lane highway, you know, those really girthy, gigantic concrete monstrosities that they put together to hold up a 8-lane highway. That's what would be left of our present civilization. And if you came stumbling across that in 10,000 years, what would it be? It would be a megalithic block from this period of time. But there'd be nothing else around it. It wouldn't make sense. It would just be there by itself, and you'd find all the rebar inside, and like, well, they must have had some technology. They got rebar in there. They're a very advanced society. Where's the rest of the culture? Where's the rest of it? Oh, it got washed away, and most of it was brittle junk, and there was only a couple big pieces that survived. And another thing about going to the Met Museum, which, by the way, it's a beautiful place, and I highly encourage anybody to go, because there are some nuggets in there. I found some Sufi star books in there, and I was like, yo, astrolab lovers out there, or astrolabs, I should say. There's some nuggets around in the museum. You just have to go look for it. I found like 5 or 6 amazing things in there that I'm actually going to do videos on here coming up this week. Blew my mind, like just right on the, it's in the front, but you got to look for it. They're like usually high up or somewhere tucked back in a corner, but it's in the room, so you just need to look for it. One thing that, you know, was stark realization for me was how much stuff there is from the past. Like, really, how much of it is? You know, they make us believe that you might find a scrap of this, and, whoa, that's the only thing left, and the Egyptians, and this and that, and the Hittites, and this, and the Mycenaeans, and this, and the Chalcedonians, which they never talk about. I wonder why. Oh, yeah, speaking of underwater civilizations off the Black Sea, or inside the Black Sea, I should say, Bulgaria. Right around 40 feet of water, you're going to find the Chalcedonian culture 6,000 years prior. They got cities after cities after cities about 40 feet deep. You're not allowed to dive on that as a recreational diver, by the way. That's off limits. I wonder why. But there's so much stuff, and the Met Museum really blew my mind open. I mean, really, how many pieces of stuff are there from the past? Like, I went to a bunch of Chinese museums when I was traveling over there, too, out to Xi'an. And if you go outside Xi'an, and that's where, you know, terracotta warriors and all that stuff is. It's outside Xi'an also. But when you get to the oldest capital out there, it's called Yuanyang. And then that's where all the Chinese pyramids are. There's hundreds and hundreds of Chinese flat-top pyramids, just like Mayan flat-top pyramids. But there's like hundreds of thousands of bits of things that they dug out of all these areas. I mean, there's really so much of the ancient history that's still being found. So it's not like it just disappeared. It is everywhere, literally everywhere. There's hundreds of millions of pieces of history around through the museums across our planets here. The perception they feed you that, oh, this thing is so valuable, and it's just a piece of terracotta, broken little thing, and they go, oh, this is it from 6,000 years ago. But, you know, they have 50,000 other pieces in the boxes in the basement that are just mind-blowing artistic and metallurgy that you'll never be able to see. They want the perception. The one thing I noticed about the perception of the museum was, as soon as you walk in, it's the Egyptians. History starts with the Egyptians. That's what they wanted you to know. That's what they wanted you to feel, think, as you walked through the rest of it. The timeline was super specific and laid out there. Egyptians start first. Don't ask any questions about further back than the Egyptians. There's nothing. And as you move through, we're just very lucky that we even scraped and stole some of this stuff out of the temples there, and it's right here in the Met for you to see. But I've been to a lot of museums around the world, and they're all the same. The bigger they are, like in Austria, I went to Vienna, I went to this most mind-blowing, I forget which museum it was a few years back. I mean, the amount of stuff in there just blew the Met. I mean, out of the Met was like, you know, a good first grade science experiment presentation, you know, put some stuff on a table, looks pretty cool. The ones in Austria were like the real deal. So just my recollection of going from China and Xi'an and around these places, the museums there were absolutely just so full of ancient history from China. Like everywhere you go around the world, there is so much of our ancient history around, but the perception is there's none of it left. And it's so rare to find it. It's so costly and everything's a million-dollar object. And it's really not like that. It's plentiful. They're giving you a false illusion of history of there's nothing left, but it's the complete opposite. There's so much there that paints such a clear picture. But, you know, if we're at the end of the Ice Age or the end of the interglacial, they're not going to save it. They're going to let it burn to the ground, and they're going to extract the wealth. And it would not surprise me if somehow all the gold gets pulled into a single repository again. Like I'm talking the entire planet's gold supply goes into one place. That would not surprise me at all in any way, shape, or form. But Ranson, I know I've been rambling a little about ancient history, man. I just had all these thoughts in my head from the museums and all the closures and the removal of art out of New York City and all this kind of stuff. Interesting times we're in.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, and while you were doing that, I was thinking more about this idea of our disposable civilization that we have. You know, kind of a great example of that is 9/11. You know, I've rambled about that before, but we have that new sophisticated technological new skyscraper there where the old ones used to sit. And that in itself is an example of exactly what I mean by a disposable civilization. So if you live in any of those cities and someone comes along and buys the building, instead of renovating it, they usually just destroy it. Now compare that, you know, what I brought up on Pumapunku, which, by the way, is one of the best examples of a world lost with ancient technology, because there are keystone cuts there which insinuate that they did have metallurgy beyond the Copper Age. Also, there were refining, what appears to be refining facilities that they were using the lake's water for to separate metals. So there was some kind of metallurgy project going on there. And then also you see the megalithic stones that have cuts that we cannot copy to this day. And matter of fact, people have done experiments cutting it with lasers, cutting it with diamond bit tools, and cutting it with water, et cetera. And none of them match the precision and cut on those stones. On top of that, we talk a lot about the events going on electromagnetically with the earth and the sun and what's going on. Whichever generation of people were living in this technologically advanced time seemed to have some kind of really thumb on the idea of electromagnetism and how it interacts with the earth. Because every megalithic site that I know of, just about, I think all of them, uses a heavily quartzite type of stone, usually the hardest kind, but they all are candidates for the best types of piezoelectric stone to build buildings with for whatever reason. They're all magnetically charged. So there was something going on there. So not only did they know how to form and mold rocks or cut rocks beyond anything that we can do now, lift rocks, move rocks, but they also had some kind of metallurgy going on. Now, whatever civilization that was, or whoever built that, and you can argue about, different people argue about who did what, when, regardless of that, something was going on at a worldwide thing that had higher technology, and it left its imprints, you know, you could say 12 to 8,000 years ago, still there. It's still there. The evidence of it is still there. We, you know, that's why we get to look at it. Now, you compare today's cities, our best achievements, say like New York City, for example. It's basically a bunch of concrete and reinforcement bars. And you think that will still be there in 12,000 years? No, it won't be, obviously. Some technological civilization could come to one of our cities now after being destroyed or buried or whatever a couple thousand years from now, and they would only be able to know that we were even there if they pulled up and, you know, checked the soil or whatever and tested it and found out that there were some complex molecules there that had to do with industry and invention. That would be the only reason we would even know that they were there, or that they would know we were here. So, and you were getting into some of these ideas about how often, you know, places rise and fall. And an example of this, it's ironic because I was recently watching a documentary about this, so I looked it up here to show everybody. I think you say it Ba'ae, or I don't really know how to say it. So let's just say Ba'ae. I don't know how to say it. B-A-I-A. Basically, it was the Las Vegas or the Sin City of the Roman Empire. And all of the rich elite used to go there, party and hang out in the hot springs. It was the place to go. It was a resort town. More than 2,000 years ago, it was the Las Vegas of the Roman Empire, a resort town approximately 30 kilometers from Naples on Italy's caldera, peppered west coast that catered to the whims of poets, generals, and everyone in between. The great orator Cicero composed speeches from his retreat there. So it's a very famous place. Now, what's interesting about this particular city is that the beginning of the Roman Empire, people were going there using it as a sin city, but at some time, some kind of geologic activity sank the city hundreds of feet below the ocean. Now, that's not weird by itself because we know a lot about sunken cities and things like that. What's weird about it is that, you know, a couple hundred years later, it rose back up to the point that they started inhabiting it again and rebuilding on it. And today it's one of the best looking underwater cities that you can go look at. And the reason for that is because it's perfectly preserved. It came up, people rebuilt it, cleaned it up, started using it again, and then it went back down. And this is within our written history where you could see a city disappeared completely beneath the ocean, but then rose again and then was inhabited again. So that's a pretty trippy thing. And the whole reason that everybody went there was because of the geologic activity. You know, so they had all the hot springs and the mineral baths and things like that. So the rich went there and hung out. So that's something within our history that just talks about one city in our past that actually rose, fell, and rose again and was re-inhabited. Unfortunately, the way that we build things now, that's not really a possibility. If you can imagine a modern city going under the water, say New York, which is, by the way, sinking about an inch a year or whatever because of the where they built it. You can imagine that if that went under the water, there would be barely anything left hundreds of years from now. I mean, the concrete would break down, the reinforcements would rust, the copper and all of the electrical stuff would corrode in the ocean. So you could just see how our civilization doesn't even seem to be built to last at all, like they never planned it to. And if you think about like a contractor that goes out to, I don't know, let's say an oil rigging area or a natural gas well or, you know, any of these fracking places, when they set up a new thing, they bring out a bunch of trucks, they set up a bunch of temporary homes, buildings, offices for them to hang out in, use the electricity, because it's a completely temporary, disposable, little tiny village. So that's like the whole idea. So when you look at what their plans are for resetting, you can tell what they're telling you is the plans, the blueprints for what happens after whatever's about to happen. And it seems like they are pretty convinced something is about to happen. And if it don't happen, they will make it happen, and they have all of these self-fulfilling prophecies that they could use as far as the Abrahamic religions to get everybody upset. And I'm sure you've seen that, different countries around the world are now beefing up their nuclear programs, sending up rockets, telling everybody, yay, we can do it too. And then, you know, it seems like that's just what we have to do to complete this cycle, and the elites have it all planned out. And they have a number of people that they want to come out of the other side of it. So think about all of these other natural disasters in history that had nothing to do with man, that completely set back human civilization to the point where it was non-existent and took thousands of years to come back each time. So if you can imagine this time, they have a plan to bring it back within a couple hundred years instead with their technology, their bunkers, their continuity of government, et cetera. And all they're doing now is playing out the different scenarios so they can run through the loopholes in their system and find all the faults so that when they reset, the population on Earth probably will be about 500 million people, will have no choice but to live in the system that they create, because they will be the only military technological powers on the Earth.
Yeah, that reset's going to be a strange one. I mean, you got to look at it also as a cost-benefit analysis of trying to get 90% of the world's population of sheep through this event, or just let them die off. And, you know, I was watching Canadian Prepper, and he had a Special Forces guy on in his last couple interviews. And he was explaining, you know, there's a couple types of people. It doesn't matter. And he was saying, you know, what we're about to experience is already ongoing and has been ongoing for the last 30 years across the planet, like exactly what America and Canada are about to go through. They'd already been in it several times because it already has happened across the planet, from Africa to Afghanistan, that there's always going to be those who are ready and most will not make it. It will be a survival of the fittest type of thing, not just brute force, but the smartest, the most adaptable, the most agile, the fastest, the most prepared, and then you come to the brute force. Those are the people who are going to make it anyway. So when I look at this number of 500 million, you know, a lot of people go, well, they're going to take everybody and cut their heads off or do whatever, and they're going to remove the population and reduce the population to 500 million. I am of the absolute belief now that the die-off will be natural, and those that are prepared will live through this, and the people that are left will be those 500 million. Of the same that was described by by the Special Forces person today describing what types of echelons of society would move through a breakdown situation and still stay and, you know, continue life. So the 500 million are the way that the elite will thin the crowd without having to thin the crowd themselves. For them, it is the ultimate hunger game. Whoever lives through and prospers and comes out on the other side is one of those that they would have chosen anyway, but they had no way to choose, supposedly. So the 500 million that are left will be, you know, nature's finest. As we look through this time of cataclysm and social breakdown, cost-benefit analysis, you would try to take zero through, and whoever squeaks through the crack, well, okay, we'll take care of them on the other side, but it's hard to decide who right now would live, who wouldn't make it, who would, who psychologically couldn't deal, who could. Just a lot of different parameters to think of. And at the same time, try to extract the wealth to bring it up to rebuild the society and restart an economy after all these things happen. Now, that's not pretty much, it's not at all the way I would do it. You know, I would make sure, like a Noah's Ark again. Are we on a Noah's Ark scenario this time? And we're not being told that we're the 2x2 chosen going through. But those out in the rural countryside are pretty much going to live through this. There will be some pillaging from the locals until they're not causing trouble any longer. And things should smooth out after the initial bump of whatever it is. Congestion of resources. It'll finally balance itself. Now, after that point, you know, another 10 or 20 years, and then it starts to reassemble itself. But the way I'm looking at it, you know, we're going to head into this new ice age here, and there's no going back from that. By the way, this is the longest interglacial that we've ever had in the last 2 million years. Actually, some people say 5 million, but the records aren't so clean going back then. But a clear stated longest interglacial in the last 2 million years. 2,000 years longer than the average interglacial period time. So to say that the planet's going to run away into a hothouse, when the last 2 to 5 million years say completely opposite, we're going to drop off a cliff into cooling that takes us down into ice age temperatures. And we have run this course the longest of any that we know of so far. And the obliquity is also changing. And if you look at Theodore Landscheid's work, and there's a few changes orbitally happening, you know, it seems like this change is moving through not only the solar system, but, you know, the spiral arm of the galaxy itself. And the obliquity is something to really take a look at on how far we, you know, come in and out from the sun, our planet, and then the charge coming into our star. And there's all kind of variables that are changing also at this point. But whoever gets through this, they're not going to really bring anybody through except their own clan. And I saw that in New York City, too. That's one thing that I noticed. I was downtown Manhattan. I was down near Central Station. I went into a couple of these really old churches that were definitely Tartarian built. These things were not built in the 1800s as they said they were. There's no way. Impossible. I was like an ant on the floor of these grand cathedrals. And when I was down there, I saw a bunch of, you know, entitled money people walking around, kids basically, with their little beat up loafers on. They were part of the money club. And what I realized is there are always going to be hubs of however bad it gets. There's going to be money hubs and those to oversee the economy that are entitled, those families that have been there in place for generations or centuries. Their offspring will always man those positions. And I saw that in New York City so clean. It was just like blew me in the face again. I had so many epiphanies there that the overseers of the economy have their outposts. New York City will always be manned outposts. Of course, they get a good quality of life, but if any kind of natural disaster on a cataclysmic cycle, they're going to pull out as well. But what I saw was that money class. In Hong Kong, the same thing during COVID. There were people who never left that should have. And I was always wondering, why did they stay? Well, they were the money class that was supposed to man the post. And this is it. Like, the world is much more complex than we give it credit for being, and our history is way longer. And there's rulers out there that are unexplained how all this wealth continues to stay in their hands unless it's planned over the millennia. So, I don't know, Ransom, is that, if you were the ruler of a planet, would you just keep your money class, pull it back, keep your government intact, keep your military intact, continuity government? Yep, that full core stays as the resetting force for the new world. Leave everybody up on the planet's surface, and whoever survives, they were the ones smart enough that were meant to survive anyway. We don't even have to spend the time to choose who does or who lives. We'll just let them all fight it out and see who's left over when we pop up in 20 years.
Well, better yet, we could just do it by design now, technologically. I mean, you talked about Noah's Ark, which is funny, as I was thinking that exactly right before you said that, of the scenario of today's technological reality, that if something happened that knocked out the majority of the population, say 90%, we got down to a number of 500,000 remaining survivors. It wouldn't take very long for the powers to be to set up some temporary station. They already proved they can do it. Tinker with the DNA, design a new all the animals that have lost. They have cataloged it. All of the people, they have taken their blood. They have all the genetic material and information that they need. They just set up a facility. It'd take them about a couple of years to get it going, and then in 20 years you have a new generation of people, a brand new generation of designed people on top of the 500 million people. And then guess what? We also have the technology to get rid of that other 500 million slowly while it gets replaced by the, new designer human beings that can be engineered now. Just think about that. It'll only take 20 years for one generation to be the young people that are running the forces of the continuity and government. They can have massive amounts of resources in just 20 to 40 years, first and second generation of people. So, in the past, it might have taken thousands of years to rebound. This time, it may only take 50 years. And then in the end of that, we have the power now to create semi-life forms, I'll put it that way, and spread them around the world in record time to get rid of any remaining outliers that might be out there claiming ownership of lands and resources.
Yeah, the size of land is going to be constricted on the planet too, because if we do go into an ice age or a cooling of that proportion, anything up to, say, 40 north is going to be icy. Yeah, the world's population will be constricted down to probably like 25 north, 25 south, and that's it.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but...